Welcome. I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Calls One Planet series. This Wednesday at 9 a.m. Pacific time, Joe Biden will become the 47th president of the United States. Over the past 4 years, communities of color have borne the brunt of Donald Trump's anti-environment agenda and environmental protection rollbacks, such as approving pipelines on native land, weakening coal ash restrictions, gutting the Clean Water Act, and deregulating petroleum refineries, also approving chemicals linked to cancer and reproductive harm, and so much more. On today's show, we are marking Martin Luther King Jr. Day by discussing the environmental justice movement's plans under a Biden administration and what needs to be done to not only reverse Donald Trump's policies, but improve the health and well-being of marginalized communities and make gains on pressing environmental challenges. Joining us to talk about this is Mustafa Santiago Ali, Vice President of Environmental Justice, Climate and Community Revitalization at the National Wildlife Federation. Mustafa Ali is former head of the Environmental Justice Program at the EPA. He was at the EPA for 24 years and then left after the Trump administration announced plans to end funding for the agency's Environmental Justice Program. Hi, Mustafa. Welcome back to the program. Thanks so much for joining us.
Well, thank you so much for having me.
Well, it's great to have you. I find myself kind of stumbling on these words sometimes because you just realize just what people have faced under Donald Trump for 4 years, especially these frontline communities, and it's pretty intense. Before we talk about that, Mustafa, I want to get your reaction to the riots that happened a couple of weeks ago. We are learning so much about what happened, who was involved. We still have so many unanswered questions about how this all went down. I just want to ask you about the latest news. Last night, the AP reported that officials are worried about an insider attack or other threat from service members involved in securing Biden's inauguration, prompting the FBI to vet all of the 25,000 National Guard troops coming into Washington for the event. What are your thoughts on all of this?
Well, you know, it's a shame that something like that has to happen. But if you understand the history of our country, then you understand when we're talking about white nationalists, when we're talking about militia, when we're talking about law enforcement that has been utilized to actually, in many instances, silence the voice of communities who are asking for basic amenities. And when we look back in the civil rights movement and a number of others, we know that there were former military National Guard, there were, police officers and others who were part of organizations that were against our country, really. When you look at the Ku Klux Klan, when you look at many of the militias and some of the others that we both had to deal with in the past and are currently dealing with here today, a lot of their training comes from individuals who have served, who have been in law enforcement. So you have to bring that into the mix, and there has to be an analysis. And we also have to make sure that we're doing a better job before we allow folks to enter into these forms of service of knowing their backgrounds.
Right. And reports have come out over the last couple of years, many, many years, about white supremacist groups infiltrating the military and the police. But this is something that many in this country just really don't want to really address.
Well, many in the environmental justice movement and the social, broader social justice movement, many of these various movements, we've known for decades that this was a problem, and folks have raised it as a problem. I've written about it, I've talked about it, and many, many others, who have even greater sets of experiences than myself have put a spotlight on this. Unfortunately, in far too many instances, we don't want to pay attention because we don't want to believe that those that we hold in such high regard in many instances would have these ideologies and would be a part of such nefarious actions.
Right. Well, we are going to continue covering this in the days to come. So I hope you can join us for that coverage. Mustafa, I mean, here we are 2 days from now and Donald Trump will no longer be in office. When you look at what this administration has done to the environment and frontline communities over the past 4 years, so much damage. I mentioned just a few things in the intro. How are you really thinking about all of this when you just take some time to step back and look at what they have done?
Well, I mean, it's really been a dismantling of our of sort of our basic safety net, if you will, or our basic structures to make sure that folks have access to clean air, clean water, and clean land, and also that their voices can be heard. I mean, what Donald Trump has done will reverberate throughout history for decades yet to come. The question really is how are we going to come together as a country and fix both the things that he was responsible for and those that existed before he came into office? You know, we got 100,000 people who are still dying prematurely from air pollution every year. That's amazing. You know, that's more folks dying from air pollution that are dying from gun violence, that are dying from car crashes, that are dying from, you know, a number of other things that we pay attention to and deserve our attention and our resources and our strategies. You know, we got 2.2 million folks in our country who still don't have access to water and plumbing. We got 2.4 million miles of pipeline that's running through our country. We have all of these different challenges that, of course, have played into the pandemic that we find ourselves in with COVID-19 that, of course, makes it so much more difficult for folks to survive. You know, I often talk about moving from surviving to thriving. We still got way too many people in our country who are in a survival position. And as, you know, 100 plus environmental laws, regulations, statutes, a number of other things that we use to make sure that people have basic protections. And I'm going to keep repeating that, basic protections, because nobody has, you know, these Cadillac protections or other, you know, just above the bare minimum protections where we have to get to. You know, that is a part of the work that the Biden-Harris administration is going to have to get us to and also deal with, you know, everything that's happened, you know, with, you know, the rolling back of the clean car rule, all these things that have gone on with methane, allowing more greenhouse gases to get into our atmosphere and warm up our planet, you know, with the Clean Power Plan, when they replace that with something, you know, much weaker that puts vulnerable communities, communities of color, African-American, Latinx, Indigenous, Asian and Pacific Islander and lower wealth white communities in dangerous situations. They have literally placed a crosshair on those people's lives. And we've seen it play out in the environmental context and also in the pandemic context that we are losing people, so many lives way before their time, and all because of a set of actions that are driven by policy. And we have to also call out the fact that policy, both under the Trump administration and historically, has had biases built into it, has had discrimination built into it. And we have a responsibility now to unpack all of that. It is a huge responsibility, but I think that we are up to the task if we make sure that the voices of people actually are heard, and not only just heard, but are actually implemented in a way that makes change happen on the ground that people see value in, not folks in Washington, D.C. inside of the bubble. If folks in Appalachia, if folks on the Gulf Coast, if folks in the Rust Belt and in the breadbasket, and of course on our coasts, see value in what is happening, then we have a winning formulation. If they do not, then we have more work to do.
Right. And you come at this from a very interesting perspective, because for 24 years, you worked with the EPA. So you had a foot inside government and you had a foot with the grassroots. Can you just give us a sense of how the Biden administration, given what you know about government and how it works, how fast can they move to overturn some of these policies? Last night, this story was getting a lot of attention. I'm just reading from the Washington Post. Signaling his commitment to quickly confront climate change, Joe Biden is planning to move within days to quash the multi-billion dollar Keystone XL pipeline, according to two individuals familiar with the decision. I mean, this is just, he says he's going to do this on day one. And this is getting obviously a lot of attention in Native communities. How fast can they really move?
Well, I think it depends. There's going to be a mix, right? There'll be some things that will be done through executive order. And then the other things that are going to take longer are going to have to, of course, work through the House and the Senate. And hopefully we can get bipartisan support on many of these things that are common sense, really. They're really about not only, you know, protecting the lives of folks and strengthening our country and, of course, protecting our planet. So some things will be done through executive order and some things will take a much longer time. You know, when we first of all, just let me call out and say thank you to President-elect Biden for realizing that the, you know, that that Keystone XL pipeline, one, didn't make sense. Two, wasn't needed. Yeah, I mentioned earlier, we've got 2.4 million miles of pipeline. That's enough to go to the moon and back twice and be on your way back to the moon. So that tells you that we probably got enough pipeline that already existed, and we need to find alternative uses for some of that. But we also, you know, some of the things that's going to take more time is going to be, you know, around the clean cars and diesel. And how we can help to make sure that less folks are being impacted by that. Again, you know, the things around the Clean Power Plan, those are things that both are in the courts, and we know that the courts have changed with all of the new appointments that were made from the Trump administration, and the, also that hard work that's going to have to happen on Capitol Hill. But, you know, President-elect Biden has some real opportunities right there on day one. You know, he could make sure that there's an environmental justice commission over the next 4 years to make sure that, you know, all of these actions that are going to happen, whether around infrastructure or protecting our environment or making sure that we're tightening up on enforcement actions, that there is a constant voice that has a number of different environmental justice stakeholders that are a part of it. He could, if he chose to, he could make sure there's a full environmental justice analysis that moves forward on all the policies, programs, and budgeting decisions, which would be critically important. He could, if he chose to, he could make sure that there were senior advisors for environmental justice, both in his White House sets of individuals, but also in each of the 17 agencies and departments that have a distinct responsibility for environmental justice through Executive Order 12898. And he could, if he chooses to, he could also make sure that there is a new enhanced 21st century environmental justice executive order. And the reason that I raise this in the environmental justice context is that if we can get it right for our most vulnerable communities, the benefits will also be there for those who may not necessarily live in communities that are dealing with environmental racism or environmental injustices. So it's not as difficult as it might seem to make sure that we have some of the basic fundamental pieces in place. Now, as we start to get into, you know, the tightening up of enforcement actions, there's more work that has to happen there, but it'd be critically important in protecting our most vulnerable communities. And when we look at our opportunities around the Clean Air Act and what additional things may need to be put in place, one, to protect vulnerable communities, but two, to also make sure that we are continuing to do everything in our power to limit the air pollution, and of course, those greenhouse gases that are warming up our oceans and our planet. So there are things that he has the power to do immediately, and then there are others that will take collaborative work with a number of other partners.
Today, we are speaking with Mustafa Santiago Ali, Vice President of Environmental Justice, Climate and Community Revitalization at the National Wildlife Federation. Mustafa is former head of the Environmental Justice Program at the EPA. He was there for 24 years and then left after the Trump administration announced plans to end funding for that justice program. If you have any questions or comments for Mustafa about where, well, really, just the last 4 years under Trump, the damage that was done, and what it will take to reverse that damage and improve the health and well-being of marginalized communities and make gains on the many environmental challenges that we face. You can give us a call at 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email your call at kalw.org. Mustafa, can you give us a sense of what you saw at the EPA? Why, you know, given where we are today, what did the EPA do right and what did the EPA do wrong? Because you joined back in 1992 under the George H.W. Bush administration. So, you know, what went wrong? How did we get to this point?
Well, you know, your vote has power. Unless you give it away and unless you understand how it can benefit your life or how it can make it so much more difficult. And, you know, for me, I always go back to the civic process if we want to understand how we got to where we are, because, you know, your vote is controlling who are those individuals inside of all those federal agencies and departments along inside of the White House and, of course, on Capitol Hill. And how we went wrong is that we allowed there to be these false narratives built. One that I just blew my mind when it took root was that, you know, science wasn't real. Science wasn't needed. Science is your enemy. And, you know, this past administration, they did, unfortunately, a great job on convincing folks of that, you know, and it really blew my mind because I'm like, when we're coming up as kids, you know, our parents are telling us, you know, do well in math, do well in science, you know, in a couple of other places. And for us as a country to believe that false narrative says that we have to be very careful with the language that is coming from our elected officials, and that it should be rooted in truth and it should be rooted in fact. And out of that, policy began to be manipulated and to be rewritten in a way that was not beneficial to our country. You know, we've got to help people to understand these connections, right, between the environment and public health and the economy and a number of other areas. And when you allow folks to play around with policy like that, you're costing our country huge amounts of money. We got 80 million people in our country who are uninsured and underinsured. And when we allow public health and environmental policy to be weakened, we are creating an additional burden on our healthcare system and the cost of our healthcare system. So, you know, we have to do a better job. The Environmental Protection Agency, as an example, has to do a better job of helping people to understand the value added that it brings, that it is there as a public good, and that it is there to also make sure not only that your life is protected, but that, you know, that you're also going to know that future generations are not going to have to deal with these additional burdens. And when we don't do that, when we don't empower these agencies and departments to better help people to understand how they are going to help to make their lives better, then you allow these false narratives to be find fertile ground. And we've seen historically, both in our country and outside of our country, how when we allow individuals to manipulate folks, how there can be devastating effects. Whether we want to talk about how it was done in Germany to allow Hitler into power or Mussolini in Italy, or even in our own country, when, you know, we allowed these false narratives to find fertile ground and then the genocide of indigenous brothers and sisters or the bringing of Africans to our country, all of this should help us to better understand how we have to make sure that the American public is receiving truthful information and information is that is not being used for an individual's gain.
You reminded me of a piece I read this morning by Greg Grandin in The Nation called Slavery and American Racism Were Born in Genocide. Martin Luther King Jr. saw something essential about our nation: imperial expansion west over stolen Indian land shaped and deepened the American Revolution's relationship to slavery. And he cites, let's see here, I just want to make sure I get this right. This was from one of King's speeches. He wrote, "Our nation was born in genocide when it embraced the doctrine that the original American, the Indian, was an inferior race. Even before there were large numbers of Negroes on our shore, the scar of racial hatred had already disfigured colonial society. From the 16th century forward, blood flowed in battles over racial supremacy. We are perhaps the only nation which tried as a matter of national policy to wipe out its indigenous population." That part of MLK's speech definitely does not get much attention on the TV networks and in tweets.
It definitely doesn't. You know, Dr. King was a social justice activist. Most folks don't realize that. But if you really break down and listen to his words, and for those, you know, many people unfortunately don't know the full history of Dr. King. You know, when Dr. King first came out, there were all kinds of folks who were pushing back against him. And saying that, you know, he didn't speak for, you know, for the people and a number of different things. And it wasn't until he built a stronger and larger movement and people saw change happening that many clergy and others began to support him. And he always had that struggle that was going on. And I think about the moment that we're in today and how Dr. King called out so many things. And of course, what we just saw the other day and how it's tied to, let me clarify, when we had domestic terrorists who stormed the United States Capitol, because sometimes we sugarcoat stuff and we don't tell the truth about what it actually is. Dr. King also had a very interesting quote that a lot of people don't know, when he said, "He who passively accepts evil is as much involved in it as he who helps to perpetuate it. And he who accepts evil without protesting against it is really cooperating with it. So I hope the listeners will remember, you know, over the last 4 years, how we've had many people who stayed silent. Mm. And you can go through your own analysis of whom those individuals were and how many of these egregious actions that happened in the environmental and climate context and on racial justice issues and a number of other issues that we all care about, you know, how they sort of cooperated with that. When we saw children being locked up in cages, you know, there is a connection to climate and environmental injustice that was also a part of that, because many of the folks who are coming from Central America were leaving because of climatic impacts that were happening, the agricultural changes that were happening. So they were looking for a better life. Now, yes, there were some governmental issues that were going on in the places they were coming from, but that was a component of it. But yet we allowed a framing of a narrative that was different than what it truly was. And that's why I always remember when he says, he who accepts evil without protesting against it is really cooperating with it. That's why our voice is so important. No matter whom is the president, we've got to get in and say, you know, there is no reason that anyone inside of the United States of America should not have clean air or clean water or be able to have their children play on clean land or to be able to grow crops without worrying about them being impacted you know, from a number of the chemicals that we often find in toxins in our soils. There's no reason that our country should not be focused on doing everything that it can to better prepare for the climate crisis that we find ourselves in and the growing climate crisis that is approaching us rapidly. So we can no longer be silent. We can no longer accept these evils and, you know, for those who come from a faith-based background, they'll understand that. And I think folks who come from a more secular background will also understand that. We have to get engaged. We have to push and we have to build accountability into the process. And we've got some real opportunities. You know, we can't be silent with the new infrastructure sets of opportunities that are going to happen. Are we going to make sure that communities of color now finally and truly have the opportunity to participate in that? One, in making sure that their communities are not going to receive additional pollution as we are rebuilding, but also to make sure that jobs, and Dr. King talked about economic justice. We know that was a big part of the latter part of his life, that, you know, folks are getting contracting and subcontracting opportunities. They're also being able to have ownership of all the businesses that are going to be necessary in our new clean economy. And again, I call back to the Biden-Harris administration to make sure that we understand that we no longer have to make the mistakes or the sins of the past, that we can have this truly inclusive, clean, safe economy that so many of us talk about. Hmm.
We are going to take a quick break. Today we are marking Martin Luther King Jr. Day by talking about the road ahead for the environmental justice movement and what needs to be done to reverse the Trump administration's disastrous anti-environment policies. And then later in the show, we will bring you an update on the water crisis in Flint. Mustafa Santiago Ali is Vice President of Environmental Justice, Climate, and Community Revitalization at the National Wildlife Federation. He's former head of the Environmental Justice Program at the EPA, where he served for 24 years. He decided to leave after the Trump administration announced plans to end funding for the agency's Environmental Justice Program. This is Your Calls One Planet series, and we'll be back after this. This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Today, we are talking about environmental justice, the damage that the Trump administration has done, especially to frontline communities, and how we move forward. We're joined by Mustafa Santiago Ali, Vice President of Environmental Justice, Climate, and Community Revitalization at the National Wildlife Federation. You know, Mustafa, as you were talking, I was thinking about how it's important to remember what happened over the summer with the Black Lives Matter protests, the protests for racial justice, and the incredible multi-racial coalition that that movement has brought together. And it's just important to not lose sight of that, given the horrific riots that we saw a couple of weeks ago.
Oh, without a doubt. I mean, you know, for me, You know, coming out of the work that I have done, both with young people and environmental justice and civil rights communities, you know, to see so many folks coming together, you know, Black brothers and sisters and white brothers and sisters and Latinx and Indigenous and Asian and LGBTQIA family, so many folks coming together to stand up against, you know, systemic racism. Was a transformational moment. We, you know, I don't know if we've ever, maybe, you know, in the late 60s, early 70s, maybe there were something similar, but I don't think on the scale that we saw. And it reminds me once again, you know, since we're honoring Dr. King, you know, one of the quotes that I've used, you know, as I speak around the world to close out is he said that we come to these shores in different ships, but we're all in the same boat now. Mm. And when I was watching and participating, you know, seeing all of these different faces, you know, some being blessed with wealth and others, you know, evolving in that direction, you know, coming from different sets of issues, but finding commonality in the moment and saying that this is a movement and not just a moment was something that I had been waiting for and working for a number of years. And, you know, I hope the listeners understand that when folks were out there, and continue to be engaged, you know, talking about and helping folks to understand when folks were saying, I can't breathe. That is also, you know, a statement, a theme that communities with environmental justice concerns have been saying also for decades. So there was commonality there. And in many of the Movement for Black Lives platforms, they talk about environmental justice. They talk about climate justice. And they talk about, you know, all of us being able to come together to help to make real change happen. We are at a transformational moment. Mm-hmm. I know folks were really, really nervous there for a number of weeks as we were waiting to see what would happen in Georgia. And of course, you know, things moved in a direction where we at least had a chance. Because the reality of the situation is, if we had not had that happen, and there's still a huge amount of work to do, and we should talk about that if we have time, is that, you know, climate change is real. It's so real in the sense that we are literally rushing toward this tipping point. And we know vulnerable communities, of course, will be devastated if we don't get this right. But everyone will literally have a cost to pay if we don't get this right. If we don't get these issues around systemic racism fixed also, there still is going to be a huge cost to pay for our country. Dr. King believed, and so many others, that we can come together as brothers and sisters, but it has to be a priority, and it has to be an ongoing, everyday set of actions. In the environmental justice world, in the climate justice world, you know, we understand that every day we have to continue to push. We have to continue to innovate and be make sure that there's real ingenuity in what we do. And Dr. King understood the same thing, that civil rights and human rights was not something that you do on a part-time basis. So each and every one of us, everyone who's listening to this show, has a role to play in helping to make change happen.
Mustafa Santiago Ali is with the National Wildlife Federation. He spent 24 years with the EPA. Now I would like to welcome Dr. Pamela Pugh to the show. Dr. Pugh served as Flint, Michigan's first and only chief public health advisor from 2016 to 2019. Dr. Pugh is an environmental health and social justice advocate and vice president of the Michigan State Board of Education. Hi, Dr. Pugh. Thank you so much for joining us again.
Thank you for having me, and Happy New Year to you both, and peaceful King Day to you both.
Well, yes, it is going to be a new day in just a couple of days. And Dr. Pugh, I mean, you were on the front lines of what happened in Flint. And before we talk about the latest news, I just wonder, based on the people that Biden is appointing to various offices, what you are seeing so far. We're getting word that Biden is going to cancel the Keystone XL contract on day one. How hopeful are you about, you know, environmental justice and seeing real change at the ground level over the next 4 years?
I am hopeful. I mean, I know that change doesn't come without demand. So there are those of us who will continuously push from the outside. Of course, I would love to see someone like my brother Mustafa Ali be back on the inside, but we know that he will be pushing from the outside as well. But we are hopeful. I chained myself or plasticked myself to the White House gates with Julian Bond fighting with the NAACP against the continuation of the XL pipeline. And so it is our hope that we have a new administration. We have a new Senate that will be on board soon thereafter. And so we are going to be hopeful, but we're also going to demand that we see the changes that we voted to see.
Mustafa, have you had any invites from the Biden administration to go back into government?
I've done what I can to help folks. You know, I've worked to help folks to make their platforms stronger and done other things that I can to be supportive. So I'm good right now. I gave, as you said, 24 years of federal service. Actually, 22 of those was at EPA, 2 years on Capitol Hill. Mm. Sometimes you got to create space for others to bring their innovation. And I'll do what I can to help those who are trying to be innovative to achieve their goals.
Hmm. Well, Dr. Pugh, why don't you give us an update on what's happening in Flint? We had you on back in August talking about the $600 million settlement, which took 5 years of litigation and 18 months of court negotiations. It was a long journey. It caused so much pain and trauma along the way. And you and others just really told us what actually happened on the ground and how hard this fight has been, but you have not stopped. Last week, we got word that the Michigan Attorney General's office announced criminal charges against 8 former state officials, including the state's former Governor Rick Snyder, for their alleged roles in the crisis. How significant is this, and why has it taken so long?
It is significant. I cannot answer why it has taken so long, but you just have to give all credit and just hats off and commend the people, the resilient people of Flint, who have waited for complete justice, in the criminal system, as well as the civil justice system. And when we look at, when we last talked, yes, we were saying that the $600 million minus the fees that will be taken, skimmed off of that, was a good start, but it did not match the suffering that was there in the city of Flint. And so when we began to break down those numbers and see what that really means for 100,000 population or somewhere there around, it really just breaks down to the city of Flint deserving so much more. And then when we look at the criminal cases, we celebrated the day that we heard that charges were going to be brought against the governor and others who are culpable, who were well aware of the consequences or what were the outcomes, the health outcomes, the dire health outcomes of the decision that was made at the helm of the governor. And he knew. And so the more information that has come about, that has surfaced, we are confident that he was aware much earlier than was originally stated. And so having said that, yes, we are happy that the charges are there and the residents of Flint are happy that the charges were brought. But are they equal or commensurate with the injustice that was done there? No. And so I continue to lend my voice and support with the residents of Flint as they push for more, as they push for complete justice as it relates to those who the charges have been brought against, as well as the civil side for what is being offered to them.
And to be specific about charges, the crimes range from perjury to misconduct in office to involuntary manslaughter. Former Governor Rick Snyder is facing two counts of willful neglect, both misdemeanors, which each carry a maximum sentence of 1 year in prison and a fine of up to just $1,000. What do you think about the charges specifically against the former governor?
I will have to stand with the residents of Flint and say that that does not match up to the lives that were lost, the children who will potentially have lifelong learning disabilities, the adverse birth effects for moms, expecting moms. It does not match up. And, you know, we often talk about the childhood lead poisoning and the lead poisoning that was or lead poisoning in general as a result of the switch that was made to the water system and the refusal of that administration and those in charge to do what was necessary to balance that water system and keep it healthy. We talk about the lead, but we don't often talk about the lives that were lost to the Legionnaires' disease and the Legionella that was in the water, and so many other things that were resulted as a result of that water switch, that decision that was made. And so, definitely, I stand with the residents of Flint, and definitely demand that. They get complete justice, which means that those at the top, and as the evidence presents itself, that these people were knowing, that they knew that this was happening, I definitely stand with them and call for the charges to match the crime, which included the death and illness of many residents in that city. And I think that it's unfortunate. I was talking to someone last night. And it's so unfortunate because when we look at Black and brown communities, when we look at low income communities, a lot of times we're more sympathetic with those people who are culpable, those people who are committing the crime. And when we don't make sure that we match the crime to the sentence, then it continues to repeat itself. And we continue to have these environmental justices all over the country. And so somewhere it has to stop. And so Flint is standing, and I will continue to stand with them as they continue this fight that has gone on for far too long.
Just to remind listeners, the Legionnaires' disease outbreak during the Flint water crisis was one of the largest in U.S. history, sickening at least 90 people and killing 12. This is according to state data. A frontline investigation suggests that the actual toll is much higher. And then Dr. Pugh, to talk about the children, 25,000 children in Flint were affected, 9,000 under the age of six. Some children showed elevated levels of lead in their blood, which has been linked to irreversible brain damage, learning disabilities. And we talked a bit about this when you were on the show back in August. In 2020, at least one in five students in Flint's public schools are eligible for special education, according to Education Week. That is a 56% increase from the year before the water crisis began. 56%. So when we talked, we were still unsure about how the money would be spent exactly. About 80% of the funds would go to children who were 17 and younger at the time that they were exposed. Do you have any updates on how that money is being spent?
I don't have any more updates other than that. What I know that the residents are really concerned about, too, are the adults who were exposed as well. But as far as the children fare a little bit better than the adults do. But the thing is there's this funding with the promise of more funding. But once you sign on and move forward with what is being offered, you don't know if there is more to come, and there is more deserved for the adults as well as the children. Mm-hmm. We also, one of the things that I also mentioned, that this is also at a time when Flint is losing has the potential to lose some of the services that were provided to the children. So you may get some funding for the children, which is going to be minimal compared to what the needs of those families and those children will be. But also you could possibly potentially be losing some of the services that were initially provided for Flint children. So there's so much at stake. Again, the thought is that the funding that has been provided by the state of Michigan, there are other entities that should be held culpable, and will they also be providing additional funding, or will they, you know, be held accountable to give, to increase that pot of funding? And if this moves forward, which the judge should be making a ruling on Thursday, I believe it is, as to whether or not this settlement will move forward, then there's just a whole lot that's in the air.
Mustafa, I mean, this is just, I hate to say this, but this is the perfect example of environmental racism, because how is the lead going to affect children? We don't know. What's the effect going to be like 5, 10 years, 20 years down the road when they become adults?
Yeah, I mean, you know, each child is going to be slightly different, but we do know the neurological damage that's done from lead. And Dr. Pugh is an expert in that field, along with others, to really be able to talk about, you know, many of these physiological impacts and changes that we've seen in the past, and that can probably lead us to many of the things that will play out. We know that when you lower IQ points, it makes it much more difficult for a child to learn. Mm-hmm. In a very competitive society, if you have difficulty in learning, more than likely you may not graduate high school. You probably won't go to college unless there are other things that come in to help to get that child, you know, the additional resources that they need. And then we also know that, unfortunately, if you don't have a high school degree, you may end up finding other ways to try and take care of yourself and your family, which may lead you down a path that is not one that is going to be helpful long term. You may end up being incarcerated, or you may end up making other choices because of these things that impacted you that you had no role in what was going on there. So I share that, but I just wanted to share one other thing, because I lecture at a number of law schools, and I just want to call out for the listeners. You know, when we see this suite of charges that have gone on, you know, and for Black and brown folks, they've often been the victims of felony murder charges. And what that means is that they often were not the ones who can, you know, who were the ones who actually did the crime per se, but they just happened to be there. Maybe somebody was driving a car, or somebody was, you know, traveling with someone, and then they got caught up and they caught these larger sets of charges. I've raised that to say, why is it that is something that we find in Black and brown communities when the legal system is happening? But when we have these individuals, and some of them, which has now been shown that they knew what was happening, don't have to be caught up in the same way. Now, by no means do I want to see these felony murder charges and that are in various states continue to be in existence. But what I am saying is that there is a discrepancy and a disparity in the charges and in how the laws are actually doled out.
What can we do to ensure that this does not happen again? What would you say, Mustafa?
Well, we have to, one, make sure that, you know, that all the information that communities need is there. Two, we got to make sure that we don't have these dynamics going on where state governments get to come into you know, local cities and make these decisions around what goes on inside of their communities. We also got to just also make sure that the resources are there so that Flint didn't have to make, you know, or have to even be a part of some of these choices that were going on. And we have an opportunity. I love opportunities. So our incoming president has talked about Build Back Better. So if that's true, then we can make sure that Flint is one of the places that we focus on in rebuilding in a holistic fashion that's going on. The other thing we can do is make sure that both the Environmental Protection Agency has folks who are going to continually be on the job with their eyes open and with a line of communication from communities. And we can make sure that our Department of Justice has the resources that it needs to also be engaged to make sure some of these egregious actions no longer happen.
Mm. Dr. Pugh, what would you add? It's important to point out, according to the NRDC, everyday citizens, you know, really took this issue on. And they petitioned the EPA to launch an immediate emergency federal response to the disaster, but the EPA failed to act.
Yeah, and I think that one of the things that we also, it wasn't just that this decision was made, that we decided that the state, the EPA, decided to allow this water system, the Flint River water, to be used after decades of being on another system without doing any of the checks and balances, without doing any of the treatments to the water that were necessary. But there's a long, lengthy cover-up that went on. So when we look back and we look back at what Governor Snyder knew and what all others knew, And to Mustafa's point, we do not celebrate in anyone having charges brought against them. Some of these people I've worked with in other capacities, but they knew. And so it's the cover-up part that really is a part that is hard to grapple with. So for 18 months, the residents of Flint drank water that was not only laced with lead, but was also laced with other pathogens that were deadly. And so when we look at some of the things that Mustafa said, we have to make sure that when it comes to crime and when it comes to committing crime against Black and Brown low-income communities, we cannot get weak in how we enforce the law. And let's add another component onto this that is heavy for me, and I know it will be for Mustafa as well. These are people who are paid to protect these very communities, these communities who are already vulnerable, because when you look at a city like Flint, the water crisis was just the peak of so many other crises, social injustice crises, and environmental injustice crises that had occurred there. But these are people who were charged with protecting these residents, and they failed them. So we have to make sure that the systems that are being funded with taxpayer dollars are doing what they are supposed to do. We cannot get weak. We cannot get weary, and we cannot negate the fact that these are people who need to be protected. The law needs to protect them. These entities need to protect them. And so I stand very strong and very firm with calling for complete justice for the residents of Flint. When we look at the civil justice side and we look at the civil charges or funding side, let's look at other cases where there have been civil suits, and let's make sure that it's equitable. And in this case, it is not for the residents of Flint, and they deserve better.
Dr. Pugh, we only have a few minutes left, but when we had you on in August, Sandra Smith-Jones, executive director of the R.L. Jones Community Outreach Center at the Greater Holy Temple Church in Flint, was telling us about how they were still handing out cases of donated bottled water to Flint residents. The lines were very, very long. So that was back in August. And we found a piece in June by ML Live about a map showing where lead water pipes remain in Flint. As of March 20th, the city checked about 25,000 homes for lead pipes. 10,000 almost had been replaced. Can you just give us an update on this? Are people still drinking out of bottled water?
People are still drinking out of bottled water. The unfortunate thing is that it was the erosion of trust as well as the erosion of the pipes. So there are so many things that need to be done as far as testing the water and making sure that it is quality, safe water. But Flint Mayor, former Mayor Karen Weaver, instituted the Fast Start program. And so we were moving pretty quickly getting those pipes replaced. There was a stall in that. There weren't too many left. I do know that there was a rollback in the number of contractors that were installing the pipes. And then there was COVID that hit, but that's not an excuse. Those pipes need to get in. Those pipes need to be replaced. I do believe that the current administration was looking to not do all of the pipe replacements, but they need to be replaced. They need to be replaced to ensure safe water, but they also need to be replaced because we have to address the issue of giving the Flint residents the security of knowing that everything has been done to restore them, for restoration for them and their water system.
Mm. Final thoughts from you, Mustafa. I mean, it is criminal that 6 years out, all of these lead pipes have not been replaced.
Well, most definitely. And again, two things. One, you have to make sure there's strong enforcement and that enforcement is focused in the areas that need it the most. The other part of it is, you know, when we talk about infrastructure, let's make sure that we are rebuilding, you know, places that have been sacrifice zones. Mm-hmm. I can't, you know, Flint, Michigan, unfortunately, was a sacrifice zone. So we have got to make sure we rebuild that. And then we just have to remember that we have power unless we give it away.
Well, we will definitely continue doing shows like this. Mustafa Santiago Ali is Vice President of Environmental Justice, Climate and Community Revitalization at the National Wildlife Federation. He spent 24 years with the EPA. Mustafa, thank you so much for your great work, and thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you. Dr. Pamela Pugh served as Flint, Michigan's first and only chief public health advisor from October 2016 to 2019. Dr. Pugh is an environmental health and social justice advocate and vice president of the Michigan State Board of Education. Dr. Pugh, thank you for your work, and thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you so much. If you have a show idea for our upcoming One Planet series, we would love to hear from you. Your call at kalw.org. Thanks to Malihe Razazan for producing today's show. Thanks to Damian Miner for engineering our show and keeping our studio running. You can find more about Your Call and listen to past shows. Sign up for our podcast at yourcallradio.org. Thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call.